If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch out.
Arr!
Arr!
It's Space Pirate Radio times here on astronomy.fm. That means it is another Wednesday evening, and this one happens to be March the 22nd, a little bit past, well, about 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that would also make it 1 o'clock in the morning. Now we're on Daylight Savings Time, Universal Time, on March the 23rd, Thursday morning. And I can't remember, UK just switched over. They're real soon to switching over to summertime.
They're still behind us.
They're still a little bit off? All right, so I think it's coming up real soon for the UK. So, greetings, everybody, and welcome everyone in our chat rooms. Don't forget to come on over to the chat.
Our engineer Michael reminded us that it's goof-off day, so come on over to the chat room and goof-off with us.
Or go buy a can of goof-off and clean something with it. Well, I'll say hi, everybody in our chat room. We've got, of course, you and me. We've got Glenn, Korok, Optronics, Twist Edge, Cassie, Michael G., Plaid Jones, Sister Plaid, Sky Guide Nick, and impersonating me tonight, by the way, is one of our Astronomy Club members, Bill Beers. He's sitting next to me. Unfortunately, he can only listen to my part of the conversation, not the whole show, because turns out that the speakers and the headphones don't work at the same time on this computer.
What is with you guys impersonating one another? You've got the people impersonating one another in meetings. You've got Bill impersonating you in the chat room.
So we're doing a telescope repair night tonight, which we have a reasonably clear night. So we have the technician from Planewave in.
And, oh, fantastic.
Yep, so he's realigning the telescope and everything like that, the software, and talking software technology that I have no clue what he's talking about, but he's straightening it out, so the pointing will be much better. And then if we have time, we'll see if we can actually do a little shimming of the scope on the top of it, the 6-inch Takahashi is bolted to it, that we mostly do the observing through. Hopefully we'll be able to get some time and shim that up and get them both pointing exactly the same, make it a little bit easier to use. And if he gets done early, we're going to go up and do some imaging tonight too.
Nice.
So that's with the big scope, the 20-inch with our Apogee U16 camera. So that's the plan for tonight after the show. Hopefully everything will work out, and hopefully it'll get easier to fix up, stuff like that too. They're also going to work on getting through our firewall here at work so that if it needs to be fixed again, he can do it remotely instead of having to come all the way out here to just realign the software type of stuff.
So, got an interesting cometary anniversary.
Okay.
So 20 years ago, it was the closest approach of Hale-Bopp,
okay,
which is the last classic style great comet to visit the northern hemisphere. We've had some good comets, and we've had a personal favorite in Comet Holmes, but Hale-Bopp was the last streaming tail beautiful thing that came through the northern hemisphere. It was also the anniversary of famed comet hunter David Levy's wedding to his wife Wendy. So, little comet coincidence there.
Mm-hmm.
And since we're in a cometary mood, may as well mention right now, we'll do it again at the end, there's a Comet Watch special coming up right after our broadcast. Terry Lovejoy has found comet number 6.
Cool.
Yeah, so it'll be a Comet Watch special followed by the usual Astronomy Ireland, welcome back guys, Planetary Radio, Naked Astronomy, and the Naked Scientists.
All right, sounds like cool stuff. Definitely got to look, figure out when that comet's going to be visible.
Yeah.
and hopefully you'll be able to actually have it in the Northern Hemisphere type of stuff like that, too.
We are overdue.
I think he's down in Australia, isn't he, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah. Speaking of Australia, they are ending their version of Daylight Savings Time in a few weeks on April 2nd. British summertime is coming up this weekend, as you said. Mm. And we, here in the United States, currently have Daylight Savings Time inflicted upon us. And I say that because, as an astronomer, I hate it. Why do I hate it? Because we live pretty far to the north. I do a lot of my observing at 45 degrees north latitude. In summer, you have to wait a really long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do not like. Do not want.
I don't think it's kind of sort of nice for doing stuff outside of the daytime, but I don't know. I'm kind of used to just the time slowly changing. You know, throughout the winter, we didn't have it, and it is what it is, and it doesn't seem to really matter that much once you get used to the slow changes. It's a lot easier than an abrupt change, I think.
Absolutely. Well, the more that you're in tune with nature for whatever hobby you've got, whether it's fishing or birding or astronomy, you notice what's normal. And to have a sudden break in things, thanks to random acts of Congress. I don't know about you, but I'm still noticing it this week. It's like, oh, it's about 6:30. Oh, wait, it's 7:30. No.
Yeah, it was about 7:30, I think, when the sun was setting. It's like, well, so if it was really setting at 6:30, well, it's still March. Well, that's kind of normal. You know?
Exactly.
Not that big deal. Oh, well, we'll see. I think, a lot of people are getting tired of the change, that abrupt change is what it is.
Well,
they don't really need it.
It was mostly tolerable when we had it from April through October.
Mm-hmm.
But some years back, since I graduated from university, so not that long ago, it's been from March through November. And that's been just crazy. So you have 3 months the year that are an actual standard time.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it is this crazy
daylight savings time.
Yeah, which saves you nothing.
It doesn't actually save daylight. It just shifts your work clock, I guess. What difference does it make? Oh, well, we'll see.
With school children, too, as I understand it.
Mm.
Like they're in their internal clocks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we'll see if it gets changed. If more people keep complaining about it, maybe they will.
Yeah, write your Congress, critter. Make it go away.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned the sun earlier.
Yes, the sun.
The sun has not a lot going on.
But one spot.
One little freckle.
Yes, smaller than the Earth. Active region 2643 just rotated on a few days ago. Well, basically, it means something to focus on. You know, actually, did I look at the? I looked at the sun today, but I didn't actually see the sunspot.
Hmm.
But I wasn't really aware that it was there, so I wasn't really looking for it. So definitely, you have to look for it if you actually want to see the spot. It's just not readily noticeable.
I have the sunspot on my screen right now, and I have a fleck of dust on my screen. And from standard distance of monitor to eyeball, I can't tell the difference.
Yep. However, the solar wind speeds are blasting right now. Almost 700 kilometers per second. And that is a pretty high solar wind speed. Density, though, is down pretty low. It's only 1.1 proton per cubic centimeter, but that still means with high wind speeds like that, it still means definitely some high latitude aurora. So people living in it doesn't have to be north or south now. Anybody living near the poles has a pretty good chance of seeing some aurora come around.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be north or south because we just passed the equinox.
Right.
And so we have crossed the transition in the northern hemisphere into spring,
mm-hmm.
whereas our friends below the equator have passed into autumn.
That's right.
So everybody is enjoying roughly equal amounts of daylight and nighttime right now.
Good astronomy time of year because southern hemisphere is cooling down. We're warming up, but it's still moderate in the evening for everybody. So, well, we're still getting some cool nights like tonight. Last night was in the 20s or something like that, so that'd be pretty cool. But it's not quite so bad, and you can still get out early enough for both hemispheres, do a little observing, and then if, you know, if it's during the week, you'd still get to bed in time to get up in the morning, so it's not so bad yet.
Yeah, that's a real good point.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was rather pretty last night. You can tell that some bad weather was coming, but got to see a very nice views of the winter, the first magnitude winter stars going down. Mm-hmm. You know, Capella, the twins.
Well, we gotta call them the December stars.
Yeah, but they're still up through March. So for us,
yes, but that's right only here in the northern hemisphere.
I know, but from us, they're winter stars.
Yes, but for the whole Earth, they're just March stars.
March stars, March through December.
Yes,
gotta find a new name for that. That's pretty clunky.
Looked at Venus today, actually, and took some pictures of it.
Yeah, it's about to cross over on the 25th.
Yes, into the morning sky. So it's just like 3 days before inferior conjunction.
Yep.
Get that right? Yep, inferior conjunction, which means it kind of passes between the Earth and the Sun, but not directly between the Earth and the Sun, because that would be a transit. And the orbits of Venus and the Earth are a little bit off from each other. So actually, it's not going to go directly in front of the Sun. It'll be offset to the north by about 7 degrees.
Yeah, and transits are an inferior conjunction, but it's when everything's properly lined up so that Venus or Mercury really does just go scooting across the disk of the Sun.
Yeah. So basically, they both have the same declination.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at today, pretty close to what it will be in a few more days. Right now, it's about 10 degrees from the Sun. 9 degrees from the Sun, and in a few more days it'll be 7 degrees from the Sun. So I didn't have any problem looking at it through the telescope. Visually, was not getting any glaring coming in through the telescope. So I actually took some photographs of it too. There's a picture on spaceweather.com that looks really good. Super, super thin crescent. I could not get it this well, though, because I was getting too much turbulence coming through the observatory. So it was really tough. Being a thin crescent, it's not real bright. So once you're a little bit off focus, if it's not real bright, like when Venus is like gibbous, it's super bright. And if you're a little bit off focus, you still get that, you know, out of focus blob showing up. No, when this is out of focus, it disappears. So it was really a challenge getting it in, you know, getting it in the view, keeping it in focus, adding higher powered eyepieces and keeping it centered, and then trying to take pictures of it too, which was really a challenge because it was jumping around so much. Not only was it going in and out of focus, but it was also shifting in position.
Mm.
So I had to hopefully add my remote control shutter release for the camera. So as soon as I thought it was like going to get real close to being kind of stopped, I clicked on it and took a picture. And I have to double check them on the camera and see how well I did, see if I've got any of them. I'm sure most of them are going to be a little bit what look like double exposures just because it just shifted real fast like that. The tough part is when you're focusing, the focus is real touchy, and you have to focus exactly when it's stable, which is rare because you can get a false focus. So you can get it focused, but the air is just refocusing it. So you have to basically, and it's refocusing it in an off-center position. So you have to constantly keep focusing and figure out when you're focused, when it's actually stopped the air turbulence. You know what I'm saying? Really touchy getting that exactly focused. And then trying to take a picture while it's jumping around, going in and out of focus and up and down and sideways at the same time too. So really a challenge. Well, our observatory, you're attached to a building in a city. So it's kind of hard to get really good stable air like it really
needs.
Yes, but I am getting...
Not to mention your light dome.
Yeah. Well, this is during the daytime.
Yeah. It's a compromised observatory any way you slice it, unfortunately. Yeah.
So this is the first time I've always been meaning to do this. First time I've ever really tried to take a picture of Venus during conjunction. And so far, so good. I think our weather in a few more days is actually going to be cloudy. So I think this is probably going to be the best I could do. I was hoping to, you know, maybe get like a little bit of a ring all the way around Venus, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to be a little too far away to do that.
The ring caused by the light being scattered by the cloud tops?
by the atmosphere of Venus. Yep.
Yeah. Nice.
But don't think I'm going to get it. But I'll see.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is the last clear night we're having in several days, as you feared.
I think so too. So I don't think I'll actually be able to get it on conjunction, unfortunately. But this is one of the better ones for doing that because it is pretty far away from the sun, 7 degrees. Not so bad, but you still have to be careful. Don't accidentally get your scope into the sun, because you could obviously ruin your vision, or you can burn a hole in the side of your telescope. You can burn a hole in your camera. Really risky to do.
Well, as we said last week, Marty has long experience with this. Yes. Don't try this at home, kids.
Yes, indeed. Definitely a touchy one to do. Well, let's see what's going on in the world of NASA.
Ah, okay.
Let's see. We got a spacewalk coming up on Friday.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Sunday, another one on Sunday. Another one on the Friday after that, Friday the 7th. I think that's mostly it for the International Space Station. Let's see. Now, I did do a little research on the discussion from last week, or the week before, of meteorites.
Magnetic versus non-magnetic meteorites?
Yes,
or rather,
indeed.
Stony versus iron meteorites?
That's right. So I did some research. I talked to our geologist here at work, and I'm actually going to get him on air, so we will get a whole discussion on meteorites. Cool. And he asked me what else. I said, how about planetary geology? He says, yep, we can do that. So I'll get him on when I can. I just want to quick mention right now that we will not be on air next Wednesday, Space Prior. That'll be a repeat. So just to let everybody know ahead of time, we will have a repeat next Wednesday.
Yep, Classic is airing next Wednesday.
That's right. All right, so meteorites. I did look it up. The question was, we know that the iron meteorites, you can stick a magnet to, and it's an easy way of finding them.
Iron and nickel.
Iron and nickel, yes. Which I didn't look up nickel to see if that was attracted to a magnet or not. I thought it wasn't.
Oh, yeah, it totally is. No, actually, American nickels have so little nickel content that they are not magnetic coins.
Okay.
And that is the form in which most Americans tend to think of nickels.
Right.
But Canadian nickels, not modern ones, I don't think, but Canadian nickels of fairly recent vintage were still magnetic.
Okay.
Because they had enough nickel content to be. So iron, steel, which is, of course, derived from iron, cobalt, right, and nickel are the magnetic metals.
Okay, a magnet will stick to them.
Yep.
All right. Now, I looked up the other type, the rocky ones that we're talking about, called chondrites. They do have some iron in them, but usually a fairly small amount, from 10 to 20, maybe 25%, something like that. So depending on – I mean, Glenn asked the question last week, are they all magnetic? Well, not all of them. Are most of them magnetic? That's kind of variable. Because that small amount of iron in them, you can sort of use a magnet. What I would think, if it's got a fair amount, even though it's mostly rocky, if it's got a fair amount of iron in it, you should be able to get a magnet to stick to it. Now, it's going to depend on the strength of the magnet, too. So if you have a weak magnet, maybe not so much. Now, if there's not that much metal in it, and magnet's not real strong, most likely it will not stick to it at all, even though there's some metal in there.
Right. I mean, when we were meteorite hunting last year in Holbrook, we had been given information that our host shared with us, that it turned out he'd been given bad information, but we'd been told that it was going to be a non-iron, in other words, a chondrite meteorite fall.
Uh-huh.
So a metal detector would be pointless. Don't lug a metal detector out to the desert because it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas turns out that yes, it would have been a metallic meteorite fall, and a metal detector would have made things much easier for us.
Mm-hmm.
So from a practical standpoint, okay, how strong is your magnet?
Yes.
Are you looking with a metal detector? A piece of advice that we give, say, people in Michigan, where the ground is not a terribly good place to be hunting for meteorites, go up on the roof and with a magnet and see what kind of micrometeorites you can pick up with a whatever magnet you have at hand.
Stronger the better.
Yeah. I mean, you get a strong enough meteorite, you'll attract more things, obviously. But, I'm kind of using a metal detector as my cutoff point between can I find it, or is a metal detector one more piece of junk I've got in the field?
Mm-hmm. Also want to kind of define magnetic versus magnetized.
Good point.
Magnetized would mean that it is a magnet, and meteorites are not magnets. You can get a fission iron one, you can get a magnet to stick to it, but it's not magnetized itself. So you cannot put a meteorite up against a piece of metal and pick the piece of metal up with the meteorites. I was also thinking about ways of testing. I seem to remember the idea of using a compass near a meteorite and a needle, because it's so sensitive and, you know, very well balanced that you can get it to deflect towards the meteorite, but you might not necessarily be able to get a magnet to stick to it.
Right. I've heard of that. I've never tried it.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of if you have a strong magnet, like on a string, and you bring it closer to the meteorite, maybe you can get it to deflect towards it and actually see that too. Or bring, I would say, have the magnet dangling from a string and then bring the meteorite closer to it and see if it starts to deflect the magnet on the string. So that's our research. That's what I found out so far, but I will get our geologist, and we'll talk all about meteorites another time.
That'll be cool.
Mm-hmm. He says he's going to show me some, too. He didn't have any time, any today, too. Oh, one other type of rocky one is called a carbonaceous chondrite. Those are pretty rare, and they don't have any metal in them at all.
Yeah. Also, lunar and Martian meteorites would not.
Yeah.
But, you know, good luck stumbling across any of those.
Yep. And I was asking, too, about what's common as far as being found or what's common as being out in space. So I guess the carbonaceous chondrites are rare in space and obviously on the ground, too.
Yeah.
And the chondrites are much more common, but hard to find because you can't just sweep a magnet on the ground and pick them up.
Can't sweep, yeah. No, the metal detector aspect makes things a lot easier.
Yep. Oh, let's see. Where do we want to go?
I've got a lot of planetary stories this week.
Okay.
So here's a nice one. We've talked a few times about the larger moon of Mars, Phobos, which at some point is going to break apart. It is spiraling inward towards Mars. It will, at a certain point in time, about 70 million years, so you know, don't mark your calendar. It's going to reach the limit where a asteroid or moon is going to be torn apart by the interactions with the larger planet. Okay, so that's too bad for Phobos. Very cool for whatever kind of beings are paying attention 70 million years from now. Well, there's a pair of NASA-funded scientists at Purdue University that have a model that claims that debris from earlier collisions, asteroids slamming into Mars, caused rings in the past. So a collision 4.3 billion years ago, the one that formed the North Polar Basin, would have resulted in debris that became rings. And then the rings eventually rained down on Mars in, you know, piles of sediment, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Trying to get to my astronomical almanac to find out what's happening with the planets and the moon this week. This week, I gotta type it.
While you're looking, I got a couple more stories on planets. Another one on Mars, because of course we've got a lot of probes on Mars and probes looking at Mars and rovers and all kinds of good stuff going on with Mars. We've pinpointed the research from NASA, rather, has pinpointed the last eruption of one of the large Martian volcanoes, Arcia Mons. It's just south of the Martian equator. It's been inactive for about 50 million years. So it has 29 vents. And the last eruption would have been from the bowl-shaped depression at its top. It's caldera, in other words. And that is a caldera big enough to hold Lake Huron. So those of you familiar with the Great Lakes, Marty and I are from the Great Lakes region, that's a lot of space. So, its peak volcanic activity was about 150 million years ago, so when the Jurassic period was in full swing here on the Earth, and the volcano died around the same time as the dinosaurs. Interesting coincidence.
Definitely. Makes you want to go,
How don't you start? There's no pyramid on Mars either.
Okay. Never mind the pyramid story then.
All right,
let me give you a rundown of planets and the moon. Let's see. So we got Saturday, March 25th, of course, of Venus inferior conjunction, we talked about. Sunday, Neptune will be, Neptune will be 0.005 degrees north of the moon. There will be an occultation.
Ooh.
Let's see. 8 hours universal time. That would be, let's see, we're at 4 hours. So it'll be about 4 o'clock in the morning. Might be the moon up by then for us, because 2 days later is a new moon. So that would be 2 days before new moon. That would be a pretty early event. Maybe possible for us. I don't know. Might even be an occultation for us, too. So that close, it's definitely going to be a gray. So maybe checking IOTA. What was that? IOTA was International Something Organization for Timing. I can't remember what it is anymore. Look around, IOTA in astronomy, and they usually put a chart like that last asteroid.
International Occultation Timing Association.
All right, so look for that. And see if maybe do more on this on Friday show. And see if we can figure out where that gray, there's got to be a grays line for this too somewhere. So that means you would actually be able to see Neptune go in and out of the valleys of the moon itself.
That would be really cool.
That would be definitely cool. Yes. Crank up the power, get, you know, Neptune as a bit of a circle and see parts of the moon go in front of Neptune. That would definitely be cool. All right, so I'll look that up for Friday's show and see if I can figure out where that's actually going to happen. And I got a feeling IOTA will have that listed in somewhere too, so check that out too.
Yeah, if you need any help finding the IOTA website, it is occultations.org.
Cool. And as I said, next Tuesday will be the new moon. So this is the week for some deep sky observing. No moon. There's not much moon.
Little enough moon that it's good observing time if you have a sky, which as Marty and I looked up, we won't.
Not this weekend, no.
Yeah, those of you not in southeastern Michigan, have at it.
Yeah, so we got some right now. It's not so bad. So that's why we're testing the telescope equipment out and stuff like that and try to do some little bit of imaging, getting everything working smoothly, and hopefully it all will. So. Plus, I will... got a new piece of software for running the camera too called Nebulosity, which is a lot easier to use than Maxim DL.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Mm-hmm.
So and I'm not even an astro imager, so if it penetrated my consciousness, that's a lot of word of mouth.
By the time that we get done with the show, go back up to the observatory, that we'll have they'll have the scope all working and be picture taking time again. And then again, when we have our astronomy meeting, which is the first Monday of every month, and when the weather's clear, I bring people up and we do more astro imaging up there. So it'd be nice if the next time we could use the main telescope to do our astro imaging instead of just through a DSLR. But we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm going to hope we have clear skies for that then.
Yes, indeed. So hopefully.
And I think we reached the bottom of the hour, Marty, or at least close to it.
I think we're close enough to reach the bottom of our station identification. Let's do it. You are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. That means it is another Wednesday evening. This one happens to be March the 22nd at 9:28 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. That is a daylight savings time. So universal time, that would put it at 1:28 on Thursday morning, March the 23rd, 2017. And, of course, I want to remind everybody that we will repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So if you missed the first half, you can listen in a little bit later. Of course, our chat room is open right now. I want to say hi to everybody in our chat room. We've got you and me. We've got Glenn Cork, Optronics, Twist Edge, Cassie, Michael G, Plaid Joan, Plaid Sister, Sky Guy Nick, Kevin Unique, Plaid Mac are in here. We consider you part of our crew when you join our chat room, so please come on in. If you want to ask us questions, type into the chat room. We'll try to notice the questions and answer them if we best we can on air.
Hopefully, and we've,
sometimes we miss them, but yeah. And coming up, programming afterwards, we've got a quick episode of Comet Watch.
Yes. This is special with Lovejoy himself.
Yes, Terry Lovejoy. Cool. Yep. Also, of course, our regular lineup of Astronomy Ireland, Planetary Radio, Naked Astronomy, The Naked Scientist, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So stick around and listen for more radio if you'd like to.
All right. So I got a controversial topic to kick off the second half of the show.
Oh, another one? No, last time it was not on purpose. So this time it's on purpose?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it time to restore the planetary status of Pluto? So, there's a short paper that's going to be presented at the upcoming 48th Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Texas. And Kirby Runyon from Johns Hopkins and his co-authors are going to argue for a new geophysical definition of the term planet that would also elevate Jupiter's moon Europa, dwarf planet Ceres, Earth's moon, and many other bodies to the status of simply planet. Not dwarf planet, not planetoid, not moon, not whatever.
So it's going to swing, the pendulum's going to swing the other way then.
The pendulum would swing to inclusivity. So under this new definition, a planet would be a substellar mass body, so it never undergoes nuclear fusion, has sufficient self-gravitation to have a spheroidal shape, that has a triaxial ellipsoid, regardless of its orbital parameters. Now, that's a lot of words that allows the definition to include objects that bulge at the equator because of, you know, outside forces, gravity from a planet, gravity from the star. So the point is the intrinsic properties of the object would be the basis for the classification. And Runyon has some heavy hitters among the co-authors, like, say, Alan Stern, the principal investigator from the New Horizons mission, and a very prominent critic of the IAU's current definition of planet that excludes Pluto. So the upshot is, if, and I say if, this were to be accepted, which, frankly, I like it, you would end up with about 110 planets in our solar system. And the argument has always been, well, that's too many for kids to memorize. Okay, so the authors point out, we do not expect children, at least not in America, to memorize all 88 official constellations. Do not expect them to memorize the 100 naturally occurring elements in the periodic table. At least not when they're 5 years old. So, what's the big deal with 110 planets? It's 110 planets. You remember the ones that are important or are planets of interest the same way that you remember carbon and iron and helium and hydrogen. And don't necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, bromine.
Well, so everybody and his brother will be a planet then. That's what they want.
Yeah. It's There's a more still, honest definition, in my opinion.
I don't know. Comets? What about a round comet? Temporarily in the solar system, would that be a planet? Comes around once every 20,000 years or so. Would you call that a planet?
If it's got the proper spheroidal shape, what's the difference?
What percentage of sphericity?
Well, adequately described by a triaxial ellipsoid, and I guess you have to read the rest of the paper to find out what their sense of adequately is.
Because there will be some that will be off the edge, one way or the other, and somebody's going to go, oh, that looks round to me, and the other one goes, that does not look round enough to me. Or
yeah, but comets spheroidal. Are a problem as it is. I mean, we've already realized that the line between comets and asteroid is not nearly as clear as we would like to think.
Mm-hmm.
And the line between asteroid and planet is not particularly clear at all. Hello, Ceres.
Exactly. So what if you have, like, it's 10 feet in diameter, but it happens to be perfectly round.
That's highly unlikely, Marty.
Well, when you look at Pan, the shape of the moon Pan around Saturn is highly unlikely.
Right, but...
So anything is possible.
Anything is possible, but...
How big of a spaceship, round spaceship, can we build and have it called a planet? At what point?
Well, that's a whole other can of worms, the same way that the initial run of satellites put up in the 1950s were referred to as moons, because that's what we call things that orbit the Earth.
Uh-huh.
We don't call them moons anymore.
Right.
At least not in English.
So, I don't know. I don't know if I would name everything that just round a planet or not.
They're all planets. The moon's a planet. Europa's a planet. Io's a planet. Ganymede's. I'm cool with that. Make them all planets. Hundreds of planets.
Maybe. Or thousands, depending on what we get, start to discover out there in the Oort cloud. Would you call them all planets? I don't know.
If they're spheroidal. I mean, that is actually a pretty big if. You look at the asteroid belt, and you've got one body out of all that debris that has sufficient mass to become a sphere, and that's Ceres. And then you've got Vesta, which who knows what it would look like if it had been blasted to bits at some point in the distant past.
So you could actually have a larger lumpy object than a round one and call the round one a planet, but the larger lumpy object not a planet.
I would take a closer look at their definition of how wobbly their triaxial ellipsoid would need to be.
So what is there any planets that are, any moons that are round and, smaller than Saturn's moon Pan, for instance?
I'm not aware of any. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
Uh-huh. So you could have some, very mushy definitions there.
It's already mushy. It's a terrible definition.
Well, it's not great, but I think it could be better, but I think you got to have some limits there. I don't think just round is going to do it. It's up to whoever makes the decision.
Make them all planets.
Yeah, make them all planets.
Hundreds of planets.
Make them not all planets. What the heck? Let's not call any of them planets. Because what's the definition of the word planet? What's the definition of the word planet?
What's your definition?
Planet is wandering star. None of them are stars, therefore none of them are planets. I have settled the argument.
That's the etymology of planet, yes.
I have settled that argument. None of them could be planets because none of them are stars. How do you like them apples? Which are apples round enough to be planets?
Oh, my God. No, apples are not planets.
But oranges could be.
Oranges are not planets either.
All right, let's see what else is going on in the universe. Ice and Ceres shadowed craters linked to tilt history. I have to read that article. That's on the NASA homepage. I haven't been reading many articles lately because of the storm we were knocked out of.
Well, I've got a couple that bear a bit of discussion. They're not news so much as one of them's a kind of a thought piece, and then one of them is a more in-depth look into something that's really cool.
All right, you go for it, and I'll think about it.
So, today being, it's still March 22nd here where I'm standing in the Eastern time zone of the United States, an effort launched. It is a new citizen science project. It's called Astronomy Rewind, and it's really cool. So it's going to take photographs and radio maps and telescopic images that have been scanned from old journals. It's going to place them in context in digital sky atlases and catalogs. So citizen scientists will be able to find them online and compare these vintage images with modern electronic data, not only from ground-based telescopes, but from space-based telescopes, making possible new studies of both short-term changes in the sky and long-term changes. And the people who are, sponsoring this really have no idea what we're going to find. It could be simply trivial but interesting, or there could be something genuinely groundbreaking in this old data. So it's using the Zooniverse platform that is hosting 50 projects, including the very famous Galaxy Zoo. And the journals in question come from the American Astronomical Society, and some of these date back to the 19th century. So you've got a century of images to compare with modern images, and I'm going to bet right now they're going to find something real interesting in there. Mm-hmm. So if you are interested in participating in this citizen science project, again, it's Astronomy Rewind.
Yeah, check that out. Here's another citizen science project from the AAVSO. They want observations of Proxima Centauri B.
Ooh, okay.
Let me put that link into our chat room.
Sure.
Here we go. So I guess it's going to, it transits in front of the star. So somebody from Vanderbilt University wants some observations of Proxima Centauri B. Now, the variation is pretty slim. It's basically 11.1 to 11.3 magnitude. So if you're used to doing some observations for exoplanets, stuff like that, they want your observations of, let's see, transit depth to be 5M magnitude. What does that mean?
Probably not a good project for a beginner.
Definitely not a good project for a beginner. No.
We definitely know some people here in our astronomy club in Michigan who would be up to the test, but I would not feel comfortable tilting my lance against this one.
Yeah, definitely for more experienced observers. Unfortunately, those of us here in Michigan cannot even attempt this.
Yeah.
Because
you can't see it.
It's a southern hemisphere star, yes.
Yeah.
Another article from the AAVSO, but I think I might save it till the end of the show.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to read this one a little bit, but I don't know about this one.
Well, I mentioned a thought piece. And so Phil Play, the bad astronomer, as he calls himself, he relocated some weeks ago from his home at Slate Magazine, where he'd been for quite some time, to a blaster.com, which is part of the Sci-Fi Network. I take it he's supplying the sci to the fiction.
Okay.
So he's got a nice piece, well worth a read, on Castor and Pollux, two of the bright stars of the northern winter that are going down. And Castor and Pollux are an interesting pair. Pollux is a big, bright star that's nearing the end of its life. It's got a diameter of 9 times the sun right now. Castor is, and this is something that always fascinated me when I was a child reading astronomy books, it's a 6-star system, 3 pairs of binary stars. And Pollux and Castor are a little bit interesting in that the usually under the alpha, beta, Greek letter system that we use for stars, the alpha star is the brightest and the beta star is the second brightest. Well, back in the 17th century, when Johannes Bayer was handing out these designations, he gave Pollux the opposite designation of what you think it would have. So it is beta, Castor is alpha, Pollux is obviously brighter, just look up. So it raises the question of, did it dim? It's an old star, it's a dying star, was it at some point less luminous, and maybe it expanded and is now visibly brighter to the human eye than it was 400 years ago. It's a cool piece.
Uh-huh. There's several stars been reported to have been brighter way back in the past.
Brighter, different colors. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Though rarely.
Some of the mysteries date back to the days of the Hellenistic world, when the Greek astronomers were observing from places like Alexandria and other parts of their empire. Now, this is a mystery that's, again, only about 4 centuries old, so something might have happened in relatively recent time to tilt the balance between the alpha and the beta stars.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Orion, with Betelgeuse and Rigel.
Mm-hmm. The only one I have seen changing is one in Scorpius. I can't remember what
its
designation is.
I think it's Delta, the Delta star.
I think Raphaeus. So.
Yeah, it's a very interesting variable.
Yeah, there's two sets of three curvy stars in Scorpius, the kind that are basically run east to west, and there's the three that run north to south. So mm-hmm. I think it was the top of the north to south ones that got brighter.
Yeah, June of 2000, so the astronomer Sebastian Otero observed that the delta star, so in other words, the fourth brightest,
uh-huh.
normally, was 0.1 magnitudes brighter than normal, and it got up to magnitude 1.6, so that's pretty bright, and that made Scorpius look a little bit different than normal.
Yes, indeed.
And so that one's an interesting star because it's actually got a companion it's surrounded by a disk of material that's spun off, and that's got a brightness of a few hundredths of magnitude due to this material that's around it. And it actually peaked again in 2011. So if you're a variable star observer, that's certainly one to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. Just checking back from space weather from a few days ago, there's been some rocks that flew by fairly close to us.
Ooh. No,
not real big rocks, but they flew by pretty close. Like on March 19th, there's one that was about a 20-footer that flew by one-third of the distance to the moon. So that would be about 75,000 miles away, because the moon's about 250,000 miles approximately. March 20th, 4-meter one, so that would put it at about 12 feet. That flew 2/10 of the lunar distance, so about 50,000 miles away. March 20th, also one about 15 feet in diameter, flew at, again, about 75,000 miles away from us. It flew by. So it would have been some nice meteor going through the atmosphere if any of those came in. Reasonably close. A few more, let's see. Nothing that close. There's one tomorrow or today, the 23rd, actually, about 60 feet in diameter. It's going to be a little less than 2 moon distances away.
Okay.
1.7 lunar distances. So what would that put it about 400,000 miles away, something like that. Still not big enough to see through a telescope, though. April the 19th, that's a big rock, but kind of far away, a little bit more than 1 million miles away. But it's about 6/10 of a mile in diameter, 1 kilometer. That's pretty big for only 1 million miles away.
That is.
It is. Most of those are like 10 to 15 million miles away, and this one just 1 million miles away-ish. Like that. But I think I looked this one up before, and I still don't think it's visible. It was something around, what was it, 11th magnitude or something like that. So kind of big, but kind of far away. I have to get some more information. But that's not until April 19th, so I'll check that out a little bit more.
Well, I got a little cultural story that I wanted to cover last week, but we didn't have time, okay. So I'll mention it now. So, of course, Hidden Figures was a big surprise smash hit at the box office, this being mm-hmm. the story of several of the women who made invaluable contributions to the space race from Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. Now, there's also a new nonfiction book called The Glass Universe, which is about the female computers, or it was females, women crunching the numbers, looking at things, taking the data, dealing with the data, writing papers about the data, making conclusions from the data. In other words, being scientists and everything but actual name at the Harvard College Observatory in the late 18th through mid-20th century. Well, there's a play that's being dramatized right now. It's called Silent Sky. And so there's a fun little review of this play that the main character is Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who decoded the significance of what we call sepia variables, which helped us to understand the vast scale of the universe in a way that was not previously understood. And so it's even if you're never going to see the play because you're nowhere near where it's being staged, do have a look because it's an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. And you might be interested in staging the play somewhere closer to home. It's called Silent Sky.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see. All kinds of articles. Space missions. Don't forget, we still got Juno going around Jupiter. Got Cassini at Saturn. We still have Dawn at Ceres. Mm-hmm. Let's see. It's still some. Oh, by the way, you were talking about with Gemini earlier, Castor and Pollux.
Yeah.
We still got the asteroid Vesta is still in Gemini and only about 6th, 7th magnitude, something like that. So while you're waiting for Jupiter rise, go look for the asteroid Vesta. Now, Ceres is a little too far down. Most of the good planets are pretty much gone. Venus is gone. Mars is still kind of there, still hovering above the western.
Mercury's making a little appearance soon.
And so in between, wait for Jupiter, we've got the asteroid Vesta. So give that a shot. Pretty easy to find. A pair of binoculars will do it if you know right where to look for it. So star charts for that are all over the place. So get some observations of Vesta in. And then Jupiter rising, of course, always observing its moons and surface features. So time to get the scopes out, start observing, keep an eye out for comet hits. You never know when one could hit. So instead of just doing a quick look at the moons, check your observing conditions, your sky conditions, see if you got the clarity, and take a really close look at the surface of Jupiter and see if you see extra bright spots or extra dark spots, things that are just basically changing on the planet. It could happen at any time, and we've seen it happen kind of a lot in the past 20-ish years or so. So definitely worth looking, giving a little extra look at Jupiter and see if something appears. What we really need now is a comet hit with the space probe going around.
Yeah, leave a nice scar on the face of Jupiter.
With Juno orbiting around there, that would be perfect timing. And let's see, where was I looking at the moons at? Project Pluto.
Yep.
And coming up, I think it's sometime, I said it last time, but sometime in April, I think it's the 17th. We're unfortunately not here in North and South America, but around Asia, Eastern Europe, something like that, you'll actually be able to see one of the moons pass its own shadow on the surface of Jupiter. That's right at opposition. Always a good event to see. And, of course, I always promote watching Callisto passing north or south of Jupiter. It happens a couple times a month, too. So go to inthesky.org and look up the Jupiter chart for that, and you'll be able to figure it out. And report some observations, too.
So I've got a little equinox story.
All righty.
And it's about an astronomically aligned building. And, of course, we've talked about that sometimes in the past, particularly in the context of the ancient Mayans.
Is it a pyramid?
No, it is not a pyramid.
We could have ended with a pyramid story.
It is a Catholic church in Goa, which is a Portuguese-influenced area in India. And so the church is 350 years old. And the Portuguese had been in Goa even earlier than that. So it's a quite an old parish, a 450-year-old parish. This was the 5th iteration of the church building. And so the parish priest notes that the architects of the old churches in Goa really took care when it came to aspects of both acoustics and natural lighting, and apparently celestial alignment, because for 3 to 4 minutes, the altars light up with light beams coming at 6:15 p.m. on March the 21st. So, in other words, the vernal equinox, and light falls across the dove in one scene, on a scene depicting Mary and the apostles of Jesus, and then this whole depiction of Pentecost, the descent of the Holy Spirit. Again, the church is named Holy Spirit Church. So it's something that has apparently been happening for 350 years and only attracted a bit of attention recently, and it's getting a lot more coverage this year. So maybe 350 years ago is not so old that you're excited by it the way that Stonehenge excites people or the Mayan temples excite people, but I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah.
I had a question in chat room. Let's see. About can we see all major moons' shadows on the face of Jupiter? Yes and no. Not this year, Glenn, because the tilt of the orbit of the moons is getting more pronounced, the fourth moon, Callisto, will not pass in front of Jupiter itself, and its shadow will not pass in front of Jupiter itself. But when the tilt is less, which happens every 6 years, then you would be able to see the moon and its shadow on the face of Jupiter. So not this year. And we just had that alignment a year or so ago, so it's going to be about another 4 or 5 years before we get the plane of the moons lined up on Jupiter again. So not for about another 4 or 5 years.
Glenn did clarify that he meant all four at once, and actually that one is not possible.
Isn't it?
No.
Just by the dynamics?
The moons are in resonance with one another, so you can get up to three at one time, but you cannot get four at one time. So you can't get four occultations, you cannot get four transits, you cannot get four shadow transits.
Okay.
But three is, that's why we got so excited several years ago when there was a triple shadow transit. Because that's not too common, and that's as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to, again, go to Project Pluto and just look at the list and go down the list. Just scroll every day and see if you see things like three different moon numbers and three different start numbers. So, for instance, if one moon starts a transit, and then second moon starts a transit, third moon starts a transit, that's where you'll know that. And that within a reasonable amount of time, then you'll know that they're all transiting at the same time. So just have to kind of go down the list and do a little bit of ciphering. And that's how I deciphered that on April the 7th, I think it is, that's when third moon will actually pass its shadow on the surface of the planet. Yeah. And it'll be cloudy.
Of course.
Well, actually, it doesn't matter because we can't see it here from North to South America. It's the other side of the world.
Yeah, so somebody else can enjoy it, but we won't.
Yep, so we'll let more people know about that. All right, let's see. Where was that? All right, it's not as bad as it sounds. We'll see.
Okay.
I don't know if this will take
us.
Lay
it on me.
All right. The AVSO, American Association of Variable Star Observers, is having a program called Adopt a Variable Star Program.
Okay.
And we've heard about buying a star or
yeah,
name a star and stuff
star.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so always a gimmick. So this one is Adopt a Variable Star Program. Now, with the way I read things, are we adopting a variable star or are we adopting a variable star program? Yeah, I read things inside out and backwards sometimes. So yeah, it's actually, you know, adopt a star, a variable star. It's for a period of 1 year. It's a donation of $30, tax deductible in the U.S. to the American Association of Variable Star Observers. So it's a way of contributing, a little bit of fundraising, and you get a certificate that you've adopted a variable star supporting the AAVSO organization. So.
You know, your money's going someplace good.
That's right. Which gave me the idea of a new fundraiser for astronomy.fm. What
Marty,
it's going to be
nobody's going to adopt you.
Adopt an astronomer.
Adopt a pirate. Nope. No takers. Sorry.
Oh, you just never know.
Yeah, I give it a whirl, man. Money's money, but I don't see it happening.
I can go pretty cheap, you know.
All right, I think that's a wrap for 1 week.
We're pretty close to it, yeah. Just about a minute and a half left or so. So I thank everybody that's been listening in tonight. Don't forget, we will repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And coming up, of course, we have a special edition of Comet Watch. Yep. A quick version of interview with Terry Lovejoy. And also, don't forget, tune in and listen to Astronomy Ireland. Always say hi to the guys out of Astronomy Ireland. Always follow Space Pirate Radio and Planetary Radio and Planetary Society. Naked Astronomy, the Naked Scientist. All coming up here on astronomy.fradio. And let's say hi again to everybody that's been in our Earth, that's still in our chat room.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website, It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
AFM.